Our next speaker will be Paul Hansen. I count on Paul because he knows everything about French Revolutionary politics and thinks about it with great nuance. He has written two impressive books on federalism. He has also, among his many works, written a book called Contesting the French Revolution, which is innovative in its way that it weaves together historiography and the history of the revolution. He is now boldly taking on the project of writing a book that compares the French Revolution and the Chinese Revolution. And his paper will be from, Jacobins and Red Guards, Reflections on Revolutionary Terror from a Comparative Perspective.
Thank you, Suzanne. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to talk today, as Suzanne just said, about a book project that I've been working on for the past 2 years, comparing the terror in the French Revolution to the Cultural Revolution in China.
This project has had a long gestation. I turned 16 in 1968, a year in which students around the globe were captivated by the student uprisings in Paris, the Prague Spring of Alexander Dubček, the Red Guards and the Cultural Revolution in China, and the burgeoning anti-Vietnam War protests on college campuses all across the United States. I also got my first serious introduction to the French Revolution that year, and found myself particularly fascinated by the fact that a body calling itself the Committee of Public Safety should have overseen the imposition of the terror in the year two. My first term in college in 1970, I took a seminar on comparative revolutions, probably not a wise choice for a first-year student. Some years later, as a graduate student at Berkeley, I sat in on a graduate seminar on comparative revolutions taught by Martin Malia,
and found that we were reading many of the same books that I had struggled through years earlier. This was the same year that Theda Scotchpole's book, States and Social Revolution, appeared. I asked Professor Malia why we were not reading it. And he replied that it was because the European revolutions and the Chinese revolution were simply not cognate, and therefore could not be fruitfully compared. I think it was probably that comment that perversely inspired me to write the book that I'm working on now. Further inspiration came in the late 1980s, when memoirs written in English by victims of the Cultural Revolution began to appear. To the Storm by Yue Dayun and Life and Death in Shanghai by Nian Cheng were among the first, but many more were to follow, and indeed they continue to appear here in 2016. I should probably also note here that I developed a second field in Chinese history while at Berkeley, working principally with Fred Wakeman, and felt confident enough in my background in that area that for the first 15 years of my career at Butler, I regularly taught courses in modern Chinese history until we hired an East Asian specialist who could do that better than I. 1989 was, of course, the bicentennial of the French Revolution, but it was also the 70th anniversary of the May 4th movement in China, which prompted tens of thousands of Chinese students to occupy Tiananmen Square for weeks on end. In early May that year, I attended an international conference on the bicentennial in Washington, D.C., and there I listened to Professor Zhang Zhilian of Beijing University speak about the legacy of the French Revolution in China. His father had sat for the very last imperial examination in 1905, the rigorous three-day ordeal by which Confucian literati were selected to serve in the Qing bureaucracy. Professor Zhang had safeguarded his father's eight-legged essay through the years of the Cultural Revolution at great peril to himself and his family. In that essay, his father had quoted from Montesquieu and Rousseau, not your typical eight-legged Confucian essay. Now, almost a century later, Professor Zhang said, thinking no doubt of his own students then gathered on Tiananmen Square, now perhaps the French Revolution would finally be realized in China. When the tanks rolled onto the square 3 weeks later, I was in Paris, sitting in the Bibliothèque Nationale, where I should have been reading a pamphlet by Robert Lindet. Instead, I found myself transfixed by the accounts of events in China in the pages of Libération and Le Monde, which I found to be far more nuanced and insightful than what I had been reading in the United States before leaving home. Among other things, the events on Tiananmen Square that year reopened wounds not yet healed from the Cultural Revolution. For me, then, the French Revolution and the Chinese revolutions have always spoken to each other. This project received a bit of scholarly encouragement in a volume of essays published just last year, to which Julian Borg contributed a piece, edited by Keith Baker and Dan Edelstein. In their introduction to Scripting Revolution, Baker and Edelstein called on historians to adopt a more diachronic model of revolutionary transmission to consider, quote, the impact of revolutions on each other over the long durée, end quote. Coincidentally, about the same time that I read Baker and Edelstein last summer, I was also reading Guobin Yang's The Red Generation and Political Activism in China, in which he proposes, quote, a performance theory of collective violence, end quote, as a way to understand the Red Guards of Chongqing, who, he argues, had adopted revolution as a sort of sacred script, although a script that allowed them to improvise. My interest in this project, though, is less in exploring the long-term impact of the French Revolution and its terror on the Chinese Revolution than it is to examine the ways in which these two terrors speak to each other. So today I would like to share a few reflections about revolutionary terror in comparative perspective. It is hard to think of the terror in France or in China without thinking of Robespierre and Mao Zedong. The terror came to an end in both cases with the deaths of these leaders. Denounced at the time of their death as tyrants, both Robespierre and Mao became scapegoats for the terror among those who survived, many of whom shared responsibility themselves for the terror their countries had endured. It is now common among historians of the French Revolution to observe that the Thermidorian indictment of Robespierre is responsible for the modern perception of the man himself and of the terror he is alleged to have imposed in the pursuit of his own power. Peter McPhee's recent biography is exemplary in that correction. This is less true of Chinese historians. One recent history of the Cultural Revolution, for example, by Rodney McFarquhar and Michael Schoenhals, is entitled Mao's Last Revolution. Frank DeCotter's The Cultural Revolution, A People's History, published just last year, makes reference at several points to Mao's killing quotas as a shorthand characterization of the violence of the period. This tendency to blame Mao and Robespierre for the excesses of terror distorts, in my view, our understanding of revolutionary terror. That said, there is still something to be gained from examining the role that each played in either initiating or defending policies of terror. The bywords of the French Revolution may have been liberté, égalité, fraternité, but in his two great speeches on revolutionary government and political morality, it was not any of these that Robespierre championed, but rather virtue, without which, he argued, democratic government could not survive. So what was virtue? Devotion to the public good. Revolutionary terror, then, was directed against those who attacked the public good. Federalists and Vendean rebels, for example, but also those who exhibited insufficient virtue. Revolutionaries suspected of conspiring against the Jacobin government. This dynamic lies at the heart of what Marissa Linton has called the politician's terror. Mao spoke much less of virtue. This would have called to mind Confucianism, the defining philosophy of the old regime that the Chinese Revolution had defeated. Confucianism would once again come under attack in a second phase of the Cultural Revolution, when Lin Biao and his supporters were accused of having secretly advocated its return. But at the outset, it was the party bureaucracy itself that was targeted, along with class enemies. And in this regard, the Cultural Revolution was quite different from the terror in France. Interestingly, one of the seminal texts in the Cultural Revolution was Mao's 1927 report on the Hunan peasant movement, in which he had written that the peasantry was about to rise up like a tempest to strike a blow against the landlord class. This is what had been distinctive about the Chinese Revolution, of course, the key role played by the peasantry. In 1966, though, it was not the peasantry that Mao called to action, but rather young people, the celebrated or infamous Red Guards. These young people, Mao hoped, would assume their mantle as the next revolutionary generation of China. Mao's Little Red Book was a central text in the sacred script of revolution that Yang Guobin argues the Red Guards were determined to act out. But it is worth noting that another text that was widely read by students in the years leading up to the Cultural Revolution was Karl Marx's The Civil War in France. By the time it had run its course, the Cultural Revolution indeed became a virtual civil war itself. One of the intriguing similarities between Mao and Robespierre is the claim that each leader made of a connection to the people of the nation he led. The most striking expression of this in China was Mao's mingling with the Red Guards on Tiananmen Square on several occasions in 1966. But just as Mao claimed to represent the will of the people in China, Robespierre famously proclaimed, "I am people," in the aftermath of the 10th of August 1792 insurrection that toppled the monarchy. Robespierre did not mingle with the people. He was not among the insurrectionary crowd on 10 August, nor 10 months later on 31 May. But like Mao, he aspired to mobilize popular sovereignty. Robespierre was among the first deputies, as you will recall, to denounce the distinction between active and passive citizens. I could go on at length about these two figures. I've written a lengthy chapter about them in the book I'm working on, but allow me just one more observation before I move on. McFarquhar and Schoenholz introduced the useful phrase, I think, quote, moving toward the chairman, end quote, to characterize the stance of those close to Mao in the months leading up to the Cultural Revolution. That is to say, no one was quite sure exactly what Mao intended. This fits with the idea of a loose script that might allow improvisation. So they paid close attention, responded to subtle cues, and waited to see how Mao himself would then respond. In the first half of 1966, Mao was rarely in Beijing. Some of you in the room will remember his famous swim in the Yangtze River, which his personal physician later interpreted as signaling Mao's determination to once again enter the fray of national politics. But much of this time was spent on his personal train. Robespierre did not have a personal train. Meeting with regional party leaders in southern provinces, shoring up his base of support. Indeed, Mao would make 7 southern tours over the course of the Cultural Revolution. Somewhere in my reading a year ago, and I need to track down this citation, I came across the observation that Robespierre, born in Arras, near the Belgian border, never once traveled south of the Loire River. I've read I don't know how many biographies of Robespierre over the years, and this was the first time I could recall seeing this mentioned. Moreover, the majority of the deputies who conspired against him on 9 Thermidor were themselves from south of the Loire River. How significant was this? I'm not sure, but I am quite sure that historians of China would not neglect such a factor if it were true of Mao. Indeed, still today, the fault lines of national politics in China are often interpreted in terms of provincial power bases. In recent years, we have come to see the terror in the French Revolution as a manifestation of state violence, put in place at least in part to limit and control popular violence. The terror was not an extension of the September massacres in Paris. It was something quite different. The Cultural Revolution, by contrast, unleashed popular violence in China. And by mid-1967, the country had very nearly descended into civil war as rival Red Guard factions battled each other. Standard depictions of revolutionary terror tend to depict it as a descent into barbarous violence, the utter negation of civilized society. One thinks of the British cartoons portraying sans-culottes at supper, devouring babies, or the reports of cannibalism that came out of Chinese villages in the late 1960s, although widely disseminated only much later. In neither case would I want to suggest that we should simply reject such images as gross exaggerations. But it is important that we not equate revolutionary violence, popular violence, with revolutionary terror. The fact that popular violence occurred on a large scale in China during the Cultural Revolution is clear evidence, it seems to me, that this event was not simply orchestrated from Beijing, as standard accounts of the Cultural Revolution tend to suggest. It took on a life of its own. Mao may have played a crucial role in initiating the Cultural Revolution, but he certainly did not control it. Yang Su, who has studied the rural violence of the Cultural Revolution more thoroughly than anyone else, at least with whom I'm familiar, argues that it was in provinces where the power of the central government was least established that this sort of collective violence was most likely to occur. If we are to understand revolutionary terror more fully, it is important, I think, that we look beyond the center, a term that historians of China use frequently in referring to Mao and the Central Committee of the Communist Party, to take in what was going on in the provinces as well. Interesting work has been done in recent years on violence during the Cultural Revolution and on the ways in which the dynamics of that period differed in cities such as Wuhan and Shanghai as compared with the better-known scenarios in Beijing. My own work on the French Revolution has focused primarily on the provinces, of course, and it prompts me to ask why the terror was so mild in Caen, one of the most active federalist cities, and why it should have been so brutal in Nantes. The role played by representatives on mission and by Communist Party cadres in China is very important, and we now have a body of secondary literature available in both cases to allow us to explore that more fully. Let me say a few words now about those who were the targets of revolutionary terror in France and China and why they were targeted. Although we have known since the work of Donald Greer that aristocrats did not represent the majority of the victims of the terror in France, it remains the case that the aristocracy was overrepresented among the victims of the terror in proportion to their percentage of the French population. Leaving aside the question of whether or not the aristocracy was a distinguishable social category on the eve of the revolution, it is clearly the case that the term aristocrat became quite subjective as the years passed. By 1793, anyone might be denounced as an aristocrat, regardless of social background. The term had essentially become synonymous with counter-revolutionary. And as I noted earlier, it was republican virtue, or the lack of same, that became the chief criterion for denunciation. In China, by contrast, there was an effort to objectify the definition of counter-revolutionary during the years of the Cultural Revolution. Class struggle, rather than revolutionary justice, was the driving force in the Chinese terror. And as such, class background became the overriding consideration. Thus, those whose lineage led back to landlord families were suspect, no matter what their political attitudes or political posture might have been. This is not to say that it did not matter what an individual might have done in either case. It is striking to me, however, that in the interrogations of suspects that I've read in the archives in France, the focus of the questions was always on what the suspect had done since 1789. There were key moments, the summer of 1789, June and August 1792, the failed and then the successful uprising against the monarchy, the period of the Federalist Revolt. But it was what one had done or said at those moments that mattered. An aristocratic man or woman who kept his or her head down during the tumultuous years of the revolution might well have been left alone during the terror, although there was certainly no guarantee of that. In China, by contrast, the Red Guard interrogators were not interested in what their suspects might have done since 1949. The assumption was that everyone knew what one was supposed to have done after the communist victory. The focus in interrogations thus tended to be on the years prior to 1949, the late 1930s and 1940s. The aim was to unmask those who had been collaborators with the Kuomintang. The fear was, even two decades after the Kuomintang had been defeated, that hidden sympathizers might still aid the nationalists in Taiwan to turn back the revolution. The irony in this, or the tragedy for some, was that it had been Communist Party policy to collaborate with the Kuomintang during World War II, which meant that a great many people were vulnerable to this charge. Not only were the interrogations of suspects in the two terrors quite different, but the processes to which they were then subjected also diverged. In France, the machinery of the terror was enacted by legislation. Revolutionary tribunals conducted trials, and although by our standards due process was seldom observed, there were acquittals throughout the year too. The Cultural Revolution, by contrast, was never legally established. It was pronounced, and it soon spun out of control. Those accused seldom knew the charges against them. They were simply told to confess to their crimes. Formal trials were rarely held, and although victims of the Cultural Revolution were labeled in various ways, one could not really say that legal judgments were pronounced. I have, by necessity, been suggestive and superficial in these remarks rather than detailed or definitive. I'm scarcely ready, I suppose, to be definitive about anything in this project, but let me close by climbing out on a limb a bit to offer a final thought about what a focus on terror might tell us about these two revolutions. The French Revolution gave us the term Ancien Régime, but it has always seemed to me that the gaze of the revolutionaries was resolutely on the future. As Rabeau Saint-Étienne put it, history is not our code. In the year of the bicentennial, Robert Darnton proposed the term possibilism as a way to think about the meaning of the French Revolution. All things were possible for the men and some women who were charting a bold new future. One of the defining characteristics of the first years of the Cultural Revolution in China, by contrast, was the campaign attacking the four olds: old customs, old habits, old culture, and old thinking. I would not suggest for a minute that the Chinese revolutionaries did not have their gaze turned toward the future. They hoped, indeed, to usher in the world's first truly communist society, the culmination of Marx's vision for a better world. But as the Cultural Revolution began, the Red Guards seemed obsessed with destroying all vestiges of the past. It was as if a better future could not be constructed until the old society had been utterly destroyed. They did not succeed in that goal, of course, in no small measure due to the personal efforts of Zhou Enlai. And I would not suggest for a minute that French revolutionaries had no interest in eradicating the past. The destruction of royal statues, the changing of place names, the de-Christianization movement all speak to the contrary. But perhaps the weight of the past was greater for the Chinese, with their 2,000-year tradition of imperial Confucian rule, than it was for the French, with their more modest 300-year Bourbon dynasty. Thank you.